I have received from several of you some questions about the quality of the projection in the second room for the practical. I'm aware of it. The staff is aware of it. We have taken note of it. What we are doing is comparing globally the two groups that were in the different rooms. If there is a significant difference, of course, adjustments will be made. Just to say it straight, I come from a school, and I must tell you this is something that long experience with histology has taught me. If you know your material, black and white is the same as color. But if you're seeing it in purple and pink or black and white, it really shouldn't make any difference. But as I said, if we see it does make a difference, we will make adjustments, obviously, to accommodate that difference. We have not seen the practical yet. It is being looked at later this week, and the exam is in the scanner, so we don't know yet how you did there. And in fact, the general rule for the first year class committee is that with a block of exams coming your way and with a spring vacation following immediately after, we don't want, if there's bad news, we'd rather not give it to you before that time. So you're going to get it afterwards. If you're particularly worried, you might check with me next week, but only if you're worried. If you say, I'm okay, don't worry, you won't hear a thing. So unless you really insist, I will not give the results, and so I will only give it to you in private for individuals if it truly makes a difference to you and you really want to know. Okay? Now, what I'm doing today and what you're going to do today is to go into the next part of the course, and that is because of the scheduling. We really cannot wait until after the spring break, because as you know, after the spring break, this course goes prime time. You will get three or four sessions a week, and that means I'm working my tail off, and you, believe me, are going to work your tail off. And what we are going to ask you is at that point to really get full immersion into the practical material, because I think that's where things have been a little bit lax up till now. We understand that that is the usual pattern, but coming the first week after the spring break, you are going to work. I mean, seriously work, okay? Not just work, seriously work. But in the meantime, what I'm doing today and on Monday is to introduce what is really a very important issue, and that is dentin. Today we'll talk about the development of dentin, and Monday we'll talk about dentin, the adult tissue, and the age changes. But what we will not do, and because I am sensitive to the fact that you are in need of using your time to study, there will be no laboratory session or small group session on Monday. And today it will be a very truncated laboratory session for the microscope group, just so that you don't lose it altogether. I want you, obviously, to study and put this material away, but I want you to hear it at least once and get going. All right, so let's start with this. And this is a picture that you all know. And that is a basic statement that you already know all about, and that is that dentin and pulp are formed from one single mesenchymal mass, and that is dental papilla. And this mass, of course, is neurocrest derived, and you know that. And you know that while most of the dental papilla will form the pulp, the most peripheral cells of the dental papilla are going to become the odontoblasts, or dentin-forming cells. So this is something you know and you are fully aware of. Now, when you start out, the dental papilla is a very interesting mixture. We tend to say, yes, it is very immature, which it probably is, but it has some very unique characteristics, and that is that it has a fairly large amount of type 3 collagen. That is truly something that you find in immature mesenchyme. And it has also a fairly significant amount of chondroitin sulfates. But the role of the latter is absolutely not clear. But what you typically find in a dental papilla, and this is taken from a human early, very developing pulp, you find mesenchymal cells that you see here, this typical fibroblastic forerunner. You find the nuclei, you find long cell processes, and then in between you find extracellular matrix. And the extracellular matrix contains a fair amount of type 1 collagen, which is these heavier strands, but then it also has these more delicate fibrils, which can be identified with immune labels. You can identify them as type 3 collagen. So when you use the label for type 3 collagen, you see that these little structures here are type 3, while these larger ones are type 1. So this is what the dental papilla is like, and this is what the cells of the dental papilla form. Now, the cells that are going to be interacting with the most peripheral cells of the dental papilla are two in the crown. Those are the preameloblasts, and of course they will be responsible for the differentiation of odontoblasts that are going to form crown dentin. And secondly, in the root, it will be the inner enamel epithelium of the epithelial root sheet, or HERS, that are going to be responsible for the differentiation of the odontoblast of the root dentin. As you know, there is no sharp break between the two. Just the cells are different, but the message seems to be the same. Now, what is the message? Well, the message is, first of all, it is at the level of the cell extracellular matrix interaction. So the message is being delivered in the area here of the dental, of the basal lamina. And you notice that at the point when you have early differentiation of the odontoblast, the basal lamina takes more space. This widened area here is a thickened basal lamina. And as you will remember, that basal lamina had at right angles long extensions that were the basal tubules, that some people call it that way. But they are long fibrillar extensions from the basal lamina that extend into this space, like here, and that lead to a widening of what you see in the light microscopy as a light-colored space. And in this extracellular matrix, a basal lamina is an extracellular matrix. So when we say cell extracellular matrix interaction, the extracellular matrix is the basal lamina. And so in the basal lamina, a series of signaling molecules are being deposited, most importantly, transforming growth factor beta 1 and 3, and fibroblast growth factor 1. But later on, bless you, there is also an involvement of fibronectin. And fibronectin, in its own way, is as much a message that is being given to the future odontoblast as the signaling molecules. Because you will remember that when the odontoblast differentiates, after they have moved into the area, so the odontoblasts first kind of move a little bit towards the periphery, that is probably under the influence of the signaling molecules that are more diffusible. But once the odontoblasts move in this direction, they make contact. And you see here these little cell processes, little cuts through them. These are cell processes of the preodontoblasts, and they make contact with these long extensions. Here again, these are cell processes. And as you can see, they kind of make contact with these extensions of the basal lamina. This would be the lamina densa here. And now from the basal lamina you have these long extensions. And these are coated with fibronectin. And the idea is that the fibronectin allows the preodontoblast to attach to these fibrillar extensions. And that is truly the extracellular matrix interaction. And as I told you at the last session, it doesn't even have to be a basal lamina from a developing tooth. It can be a basal lamina from anywhere. As long as there's a certain amount of fibronectin in it, the preodontoblast will develop further and become odontoblast. So this is not so much a directive as a permissive interaction. Okay, remember what when we started out. This is truly a permissive interaction. And here you see these lamina densa extensions. They were first described by a gentleman by the name of Inoue. And these are taken from different papers that he wrote with different co-authors. But the thing is that these extensions do not have type 4 collagen, but everything else is the same as the lamina densa. Now, here it is said again, I mean, I like to make sure that we re-emphasize this point. Here again, a very good picture of a preodontoblastic process making contact with these basal lamina extensions. You see them here as little fibrillar extensions. Actually, they seem to be hollow, that's why they call them basal tubules, as you can see here. Actually, this and this together forms one basal tubule, and the two lines are parallel. But the point is still that these are extensions from the lamina densa, covered with fibronectin, and allowing the cell to attach to it, the preodontoblast. And that is again shown here by the fact that these little markers are found everywhere here in this area. And when the preodontoblasts are developing into odontoblasts, that is a particularly active expression of fibronectin in that area. So this is what it seems to take to differentiate an odontoblast. Signaling factors first, transforming growth factor beta 1 and 3, and fibroblast growth factor 1, and then followed by an active interaction, a touching, a gluing on to the basal lamina, specifically through fibronectin. As a result of that interaction, what you find is, and here the differentiation goes clearly in this direction, the dental papilla cell changes from just a kind of a cuboidal type cell to a very tall columnar cell. This is a preodontoblast. Here we are really in an odontoblast. And several things happen. The first thing that happens is that when the cell has made its contact with the basal lamina, immediately thereafter the basal lamina begins to fall apart. So the basal lamina actually disappears, bless you, between the two cell types, between the differentiating odontoblast and the preamyloblast, which is about to become an amyloblast. The basal lamina literally falls apart, has little holes in there, and that is what allows the cell processes of these two different cell types to cross that plane of the basal lamina and to touch the opposite cell. And in the meantime, what you're seeing here is that the cell becomes taller, and the reason why it becomes taller is because it produces a lot of organelles related to protein synthesis. And so what you find is that the nucleus moves to the basal end of the cell, while the future secretory activities are going to go on at the apical end. Okay, that is a terminology, and it is counterintuitive because most of the time when you have something that you say is a basal end of a cell and an apical end, the basal end sits on the basal lamina. In the case of the odontoblast and the amyloblast, it's just the opposite. So when you talk about the basal end is where the nucleus is, the apical end is where the secretory activity takes place. And what you end up with is something that is something in the neighborhood of 50 micrometers tall cell. It's huge, really huge. This is a diagram that was drawn by a very fine histologist, Dr. Christic, who has the most fantastic pictures in his atlas, and even though it appeared very long ago, it still everybody uses them because they're so pretty. The thing is, here you see a block of, it's like a voxel, a block of odontoblasts. with the nucleus on the basal side. That is already what you've seen. You also see, in this case here, capillaries. Now, that's unusual. Here's a capillary with an erythrocyte in here. Here's a capillary. Here's a capillary. And you notice how closely these capillaries are associated with the odontoblast. They lie almost in between these in some cases. That is only true in a very active odontoblast. Once the odontoblasts slow down, in your case, in my case, they don't produce that much dentin, the capillaries will kind of retreat a little bit and come to lie a little further away from the odontoblastic layer. But in the time that the odontoblastic layer is actively producing dentin in fairly large amounts, the odontoblastic cell bodies do have a very rich vasculature. Now let's see what you can see here. First of all, these cells have one single, even though it still looks a little branched, but that's only in the early stages, one single cell process, one odontoblastic process per cell. One long process which stays behind in the newly formed dentin. And in that process, you have no organelles. What you have are microfilaments and microtubules. So this is a organelle-free cell process. Now, by definition, the boundary between the cell process and the cell body is at the level of the terminal web. The terminal web is essentially a series of junctional complexes that is between adjacent odontoblasts. You have gap junctions, you have tight junctions. So the cells are very tightly connected with each other at this point. And inside the cell, you have a terminal web of microfilaments that forms almost like a little diaphragm. It doesn't quite go all the way across, but it is like a diaphragm that goes part of the way across. And that terminal web actually defines where the organelles are in the cell body and where they are not, and that's in the cell process. So the terminal web is truly at that interface. And then what you're seeing here are a whole series of organelles, rough endoplasmic reticulum, Golgi systems, mitochondria, all the stuff that you need for a cell to be really active and produce lots and lots of proteins. Again, between adjacent cells, there may still be other attachments, sometimes desmosomes, but again, also gap junctions. So this is a highly interconnected layer of cells. And because of that, they will coordinate their activities and produce, as a sheet of cells, they will move together and behave together in a way that we will talk about next time. Now, how can you tell that an odontoblast has differentiated? Odontoblast that has differentiated switches to type 1 collagen secretion only. Previously, in the dental papilla, you know, there was type 1 and type 3 collagen. The moment your odontoblasts become odontoblasts and start secreting dentin, they are only going to form type 1 collagen. And what you're seeing here in four different panels, these bottom panels are in the central part of the dental papilla or pulp. And what you find is that in the central part of the papilla, if you look and you use antibodies to type 3 collagen, you're seeing that there's a fairly rich, all the green here is positive. So there is a lot of type 3 collagen in the central part of the dental papilla. If you use antibodies against type 1, you find almost none. Okay, so in the case of the dental papilla, the type 3 is really the dominant collagen that's present. But now if you're going to look at a place where you see odontoblast and you see dentin formation, now if you were to use antibodies to type 3 collagen, you see relatively little, but you see some areas where you see a little light green, not very dramatic, and I'm not even sure this thing shows it up at all. Yeah, there's a little green there, but not a whole lot. But now if you use an antibody to type 1 collagen in panel number 2. Now you're seeing that where you have the dentin and the predentin, you have lots of stain in green in this area. That indicates that the odontoblasts have started to go to type 1 collagen secretion. Now, what do odontoblasts produce? First of all, type 1 collagen, not specific for dentin. We use it as an indicator saying, okay, these cells now switched off to type 3 collagen, but it's really not very specific. What is specific is this one right here. And this is a block, dentin sialophosphoprotein, DSPP for short, which is cleaved very early on into two proteins, dentin sialoprotein and dentin phosphoprotein, which is also known as phosphophorin. And you will find that in the literature a lot. So, dentin sialophosphoprotein cleaved into these two, that is specific for dentin. Okay? And as we will see, the phosphophorin is actually secreted a little bit closer to the mineralization front, not immediately. So, then there are other non-specific proteins. And in this case, these are all proteins that you typically find in mineralized tissues. And so you find bone sialoprotein, you find osteocalcin, you find osteonectin, you find osteopontin, and then you find one that is really a howler, dentin matrix protein 1. It was first discovered in dentin, it got that name, everybody thought it was unique, and then they found it everywhere. Okay, they found it in bone, they found it in whatever mineralized tissues they can think of except enamel. And so this is really not unique to dentin despite the name. What can you do? And then there are, to our great surprise, this ought to have something else in here, some other proteins that you really would say are enamel matrix proteins. And they are found at the earliest time when dentin is being formed. The inner enamel epithelium actually produces some proteins that you find really only in enamel. And even some of the odontoblasts are credited with producing some of them. They are really kind of still mixed up here, I guess. And so the typical proteins that you find in enamel matrix, amylogenin, enamelin, and sheathlin or amyloblastin, and some of the enamel matrix enzymes, are found in the peripheral dentin. They may be produced, as I said, by the inner enamel epithelium, the preamyloblast, but they also, there is some good evidence that odontoblasts can produce them as well. So in that earliest dentin, it's really kind of a mixture. And what we find is, and this is something that only recently people have started to look at, that many of these proteins, dentin sialophosphoprotein, dentin matrix protein 1, bone sialophosphoprotein, osteopontin, these are known as siblings. And the siblings, which stands for, and that's why we abbreviated it, small integrin binding ligand and glycosylated proteins. These are proteins that are small, that bind to integrins, okay, all of that stuff. And what you find is that these proteins are all sitting on the Q arm of human chromosome 4. They are all related. And it's fairly reasonable to feel that they are the result of breakups of what was originally a master gene that gradually broke up into smaller subsets, which would explain why they're also close together. And what you find is that the two other genes that are in the enamel are also in this same area. Amyloblastin and enamelin. Amylogenin is somewhat different. It probably was also originally in this area, but it was then moved to the X and Y chromosomes, so that is not there. But it's very interesting to realize that all of the proteins that are related to mineralization of hard tissues cluster in this one arm of chromosome 4 in humans. And in fact, in other animals, you see similar situations. Now, as I said, enamel proteins may be expressed by odontoblasts. So if this is the area of the DEJ, and here are the preameloblasts, and these would be the ameloblasts, here you see the cell processes of the odontoblasts sticking out here. Odontoblastic bodies are not visible. And so when the odontoblast first produce this extracellular matrix of the dentin, they are, as I said before, capable of secreting enamel proteins. So in this area, enamel proteins are being secreted by the odontoblast. And similarly, in this same area, the preameloblasts are capable of doing the opposite, and that is to provide to secrete dentin sialophosphoprotein, that big uniquely dentin protein. So in the area of the dentinoenamel junction, there is gross confusion. Cells that are supposed to make dentin are producing enamel proteins in addition, and cells that are going to make enamel are, for a short while, producing dentin proteins. But then they all sort out, and at this point right here, when the dentin begins to undergo mineralization, the ameloblasts produce enamel proteins, and the odontoblast also decides it's time to do just plain old dentin proteins. You've seen this picture before, because once these cells are differentiated, what you can see is this is the dentinoenamel junction right here. And as I said in an earlier session, the DEJ is, of course, between the mineralized dentin and the enamel matrix at this point. And the enamel matrix is beginning to be laid down right here, which is the same point where the dentin is beginning to undergo mineralization. So the first appearance of dentin matrix and the first mineralized dentin, sorry, the first appearance of enamel matrix and the first appearance of mineralized dentin occur roughly at the same moment. Very interesting, nobody quite understands that part. So this is pre-dentin, this is dentin, and here are the enamel matrix proteins, which are very darkly basophilic at this point. So the odontoblasts now are moving in this direction. Actually, they're moving more like this. And they leave behind them a cell process. And it is important to realize, since the cells are not moving in quite a straight line, to realize that the cell process is, in fact, the trail of the path that the odontoblast took while secreting the dentin. So if you look at the shape of an odontoblastic process, you can say, okay, it is along this path that the related cell moved as it was laying down the dentin. That brings us to the uniqueness of this cell type. The cell type that we are looking at is a true unipolar odontoblast. One single cell process. It may have a few little side branches, but that is really irrelevant. The one single process that you're seeing here makes this a unipolar odontoblast. And the dentin that odontoblast produces is what we call true dentin or orthodentin. So when you have this highly specialized cell with one single cell process, we speak of orthodentin. There are in the comparative literature very good examples of other types of odontoblasts, pseudo-unipolar. You have one, it's like a neuron, with one axon and a whole series of dendrites coming in. So pseudo-unipolar, one long cell process, but a whole series of smaller ones on the side. That's not one that we encounter, but you do encounter osteodentin. And osteodentin is a multipolar odontoblast, which looks for all the world like an osteocyte, right? Osteocyte, the little osteocytic processes. So the multipolar odontoblast will occasionally appear in human teeth, in particular near the apex, when the dentin is becoming kind of peculiar looking, and also when you are making reparative dentin, you sometimes get osteodentin. So osteodentin may occur. This orthodontin is what you really have, especially in the crown. As you go further down in the root, the single cell process becomes more branched, and gradually the cell loses some of its unique characteristics. And as I said, by the time you get into the area of the apex, you may well find multipolar odontoblasts that are embedded in the dentin. But in the most of the other dentin, the orthodentin, you have your odontoblastic cell body lying outside the tissue and only the long cell process sticking into the cell tissue, lying inside a space which is called the dentinal tubule. So, how does that odontoblast produce the dentin matrix? As it's moving back, laying down the matrix, producing all these proteins that we just mentioned, the proteins that are the important ones for the stability of the tissue, of course, are type 1 collagen. And the type 1 collagen is laid down in an interesting fashion. If you look at this particular picture, you realize that these little openings here are the openings of the dentinal tubules. What you're seeing here is dentin seen from inside the pulp. You're looking, you're standing inside the pulp, you have washed all the cell bodies away, you washed all the cell processes away, and you're looking at the dentin matrix, and here are the openings inside the dentinal tubule where the cell processes were located. But now what you're seeing is the actual matrix of the collagen fibers. And if you look closely, the collagen fibers run around the openings of the tubules in what has been described as a bird's nest arrangement. All of you have some image, I hope, of a bird's nest. You may have seen a few in your life, I hope. And so when you looked at a bird nest, you realize that the birds are very clever. They are able to take little twigs and bend them around and put them around that center part of the nest. And that's essentially how the collagen fibers in the pulp are arranged, which means that they are arranged at right angles to the direction of the odontoblastic process and the dentinal tubule. So if you have a dentinal tubule, and this is why we have still old-fashioned old-fashioned pointers. If this is an odontoblastic process, the collagen fibers are running at right angles in the plane around that odontoblastic process. They can run in any direction as long as they are at right angles to the odontoblastic process. Okay? Capisce? Good. It's still good to have a pointer like this. Okay then. So what you're seeing, that this is type 1 collagen. Okay? Type 1 collagen that you're seeing inside that matrix. And then you see something else. You see here these little pointers. There is another group of fibers that we will come to in a moment. They have been called von Korff's fibers. And just tuck it away in your mind for a moment. They are somewhat different, and there's a lot going on here. Now, so how is the fibers matrix arranged in the dentin? If this is the course of a dentinal tubule, you see that typical S-shaped curvature of dentinal tubules with the odontoblastic process inside. The fibrous matrix, the collagen of the fibrous matrix, will run at right angles to that, while on the opposite side, if this were it's hard to see, but I think you can see that line, if this is the odontoblastic process, here the collagen fibers run at right angles in this direction. And so you come to a point in where you have this kind of arrangement where in the incisal area there is a sharp boundary between the collagen fibers from one side and the collagen fibers from the other side. And that's why in a polarized light image with first order red plate, on one side it is shown as yellow and on the other side it's shown as blue. And that is very typical because it tells you that the collagen fibers are running perpendicular to the odontoblastic processes on both sides, but that at some point there is a sharp boundary in difference in the course of the collagen fibers. So that's one thing. But then you may notice something else. You may notice that there's a little area here that seems to stain slightly different from the rest. And now let's go for that. And that is known as mantle dentin. Mantle dentin is right here and right here. It is the first laid down dentin immediately below the dentinoenamel junction. And it's not very thick layer. It's approximately 100 micrometers. Not huge. And in that particular area, in that particular dentin, you have those typical bird's nest collagen fibers. That's all right. And you see them everywhere here. They're all kind of growing nicely. They're all cross-sections here, and some are longitudinal sections. But they are running at right angles to the orientation of the odontoblastic process. But then you find that there is a second group of fibers, which are, if this is here, the basal lamina, so it's very early times, these fibers right here are different. They are not running parallel to the DEJ, which is what these bird nest fibers really do. They run parallel to the DEJ and perpendicular to the odontoblastic process. But here you have a group of fibers that runs parallel to the odontoblastic process and perpendicular to the DEJ. And they are also a little bit thicker. Now, these thick fibers are thought to be guided by the fibrillar extensions of the basal lamina. And just making a point here, which we'll come back to again, they are not von Korff's fibers. And you're sitting here and thinking, what the hell does she mean by von Korff's fibers? Coming to that, okay? Let's, one thing at a time. So, in the most peripheral dentin, you have two populations of collagen fibers. The ones that are doing what they do everywhere in the dentin, that is these bird nest fibers, parallel to the DEJ, perpendicular to the odontoblastic processes. And then, in the mantle dentin only, and not in the rest of the dentin, you have these thicker fibers that are running perpendicular to the DEJ. So, what does that tell you? What it tells you is there is more collagen immediately below the DEJ in the peripheral dentin. Next thing, what does that tell you? When there is more collagen, usually that's less well mineralized. And so, the most peripheral dentin, that is described as mantle dentin, is in fact less well mineralized, has more collagen fibers, and because of that is a little bit more vulnerable when caries is penetrating into the dentin. It tends to spread out much easier in that layer than further down. So that's what the clinical significance is. The clinical significance is that the peripheral dentin is less well mineralized because of this additional population of collagen fibers. Okay? That's why I'm making a big point of it. Otherwise, it wouldn't matter at all. All right. Now, here we come with the von Korff fibers. Von Korff fibers were seen, as you might expect, by von Korff. And von Korff, and he's very proud of the von, although in most Anglo-Saxon terms, the von is being dropped, but don't you do it, because he really was very proud of it. Von Korff was in the late 19th century using stains, silver-based stains, which when he found them, he found that there were peculiar corkscrew-like fibers that were running between the odontoblasts into the pulp. And they were kind of peculiar. They stained with silver, so they were thought to be reticulin fibers, which we now know to be type 3 collagen fibers. And they were always present just at that location. And here, this is what von Korff's fibers are, what we now know them to be. They are fan-shaped bundles of fibers, and they are type 1, type 3, and type 6 collagen. coated with fibronectin, running between the odontoblasts from the pulp into the dentin. So what do you see here? This is a preparation which where we have removed all of the cells, we have removed all of the mineral, and what you now see, these would be the locations where you have odontoblastic process, odontoblastic bodies. So these will be the odontoblastic bodies. The tubules are kind of obliquely cut here. Don't pay that any mind. This is dentin. Here's the pulp. And now if you look closely, you see here these fine fibrils that run from the pulp into the dentin. And they are not pure collagen. They are a mixture of type 1, type 3, and type 6. The type 3 is the one that was made them responsible for the silver stain that Van Korff saw. And what you find is that there is fibronectin on the surface of these fibers. And that, even though you have here a series of fibrils that are running between the odontoblasts, because the odontoblasts are capable of forming integrin-like attachments onto that fibronectin, you still have a pretty good seal. Basically, when you have odontoblast layer here, there is in fact a seal that does not allow anything to pass from here to there, except through the cells, not in between the cells. And these Van Korff fibers, which seem to be the ones that the odontoblasts hold on to, maybe providing some stability, do not break that particular seal. They are part of the seal. What they particularly do, why you need Van Korff fibers, it's not clear at this point. There has been a long debate. The fibers that I showed you before, that were indicated here, in the mantel dentin, were for some time misinterpreted as Van Korff fibers, but they're not. So these fibers are not Van Korff fibers. This is the description that we have to stick with and that we are all now comfortable with. Okay. Now, we've talked about the differentiation of odontoblasts. We've talked about some of the proteins that odontoblasts produce. We've talked about collagen fibers. Now let's talk about where all of these structures are being secreted, all these proteins are being secreted. And we find, in fact, that there are two points of secretion. One is the apical end of the cell body, and one is the odontoblastic process at the level where the dentin is mineralizing. Please remember that the cell is moving in this direction, that the DEJ is in this direction, that this is the tubule, and the tubule contains the cell process. This is the cell process, of course. Okay? And so as the cell is moving back, the dentin is mineralizing here. This is still pre-dentin. So there's always this little pre-dentin layer that is next to the odontoblast. It's just approximately 30 micrometers wide, and right behind that, the dentin will undergo this mineralization process. Now, at the apical end, what is being secreted? Type 1 collagen and proteoglycans with chondroitin solvent, keratin sulfate, you know, the works. And then a little further up, and that is shown also in this diagram here. So this is the apical secretion, and this is the cell process secretion. And that is the same thing is shown here. At this point here, where the dentin mineralization front is, the important thing that happens here is that you secrete dentin phosphoprotein. That is the same as phosphoforin. And it is that particular protein that is essential for the mineralization of the dentin. So that is very necessary there. But what you also find is that there are other things happening. And if you look at the surface of an odontoblastic process, what you find is that there are little depressions over here, over here, over here. These are little depressions, and they are known as coated pits. And in a TEM, what am I saying? Transmission electron micrograph, you see these coated pits forming like this, and then they form endocytotic vesicles. And clearly what is happening is there is not only secretion occurring at the odontoblastic process, but there is also endocytotic activity, back resorption by the odontoblasts to remove some of the materials from the extracellular matrix. Just so that you will remember, there are various ways in which you can have material enter a mammalian cell, but typically this is the one, this is the coated vesicle. It's coated with a little outside armor that's known as clatrin, which then forms like a buckyball around the endocytotic vesicle. And that clatrin-mediated vesicle is what is most often used in processes like this. So this is a coated vesicle that we use for endocytosis for the on the odontoblastic process. Now what is happening is, and this is a lousy picture, but it's the best I can do with it. What you're seeing here is the modification and some of the activities that lead to that modification of the dentin extracellular matrix before it mineralizes. Here on this side is the predentin, and from here on out is the dentin, and this is what's known as the mineralization front or mineralizing front. And what you're seeing here, if you look at this particular diagram, it's kind of a little peculiar because the predentin really should end here. This is the cell process, the odontoblastic process. Here's the apical end of the odontoblast, and you're seeing here proteoglycans and collagen are being secreted, as we discussed before. And then you're seeing here, this odontoblastic process continues on, here you see dentin phosphoprotein being secreted. But those are the two secretion products. And what else happens? What else happens is that you get a gradient decrease in this direction of chondroitin sulfates. In other words, chondroitin sulfates are being removed from the dentin. Correspondingly, there is, and I'm not sure this is relative or true, keratin sulfate gradient increase. Keratin sulfate is friendly to mineralization, so there's no problem there. The decorin is the material that can stain the decorin increases, which means that the decorin itself loses some of its own processes. I'll show you that in a moment. And finally, there is an increase in some of the enzymes that further break down the particular matrix components. What we're doing here is we are removing the inhibitors of mineralization, in particular the chondroitin sulfates, and we are adding in some of the stimulators of the mineralization, in particular dentin phosphoprotein. Here is a little diagram showing about decorin. Decorin sits on, as you know, on the collagen fibers. This is the decorin molecule. It loses its chondroitin sulfate chains, and as a result, it can now do a number of things. It can attach to phosphoproteins, it can attach to phospholipids, all of which are stimulatory of mineralization. So that is very pleasant. So when the decorin is depleted of its glycosaminoglycan chain, it can bind calcium and phosphate ions, and in that case it actually serves as an inhibitor. So it can be very, very peculiar in this area. Okay, that's a fine point, and I really don't expect you to worry too much about it. Here it is. What happens with the mineralization of mantle dentin? Matrix vesicles. Matrix vesicles. Remember matrix vesicles? These little vesicles that get popped off the cell body containing calcium and phosphate in the amorphous... Whoa, somebody falling? Okay, in amorphous calcium phosphate form, and then these vesicles will start to be the source of the growth of hydroxyapatite crystallites. And you see here, wherever you see a little asterisk here, you see a matrix vesicle right next to it. So in the mantle dentin, lots of matrix vesicles are found. As you recall, the matrix vesicles are being budded off by the cell membrane. After these amorphous calcium phosphates have been released from the mitochondria, have moved to the cell membrane, budding off occurs, and then you find that calcium hydroxyphosphate is in fact forming. And that is what you're seeing right here. Now let's look at what happens further down. Once you have had these matrix vesicles and you have started to mineralize the dentin, dentin can undergo very generalized mineralization in a very nice uniform way, and if that happens we call it linear. And in this particular picture, which is a mixture, is an individual that was alternatively sick and then it got a little bit better. When you're seeing these lines here, that is dentin where the calcification occurs in a more or less mineral fashion. While in times when the individual was probably hypophosphatemic, that meaning without too much phosphate ions in the blood, you find this kind of thing. You find little globules that don't quite fuse together. And that's known as globular mineralization. Globular mineralization is not a good thing, okay? Because what happens is, if the mineralization front passes through, it never comes back to redo other things. No remediation allowed, okay? Mineralization fails, it stays failed. And so what you're seeing here, anywhere here, these lighter areas, is unmineralized dentin. So how does the mineralization front move? Well, look at these light lines here. These light lines are the dentinal tubules. And so the mineralization front moves in this direction. Okay? It continues to move in this direction. And as I said, once it has passed and incompletely mineralized a particular area, that area will remain unmineralized. That's what you're seeing here. These light areas are essentially pre-dentin. They have remained unmineralized. So what... Yeah?
Sorry. How would you know which way it was going? Like, if you gave us a slide on a fractal, how could
you... I wouldn't ask you. I wouldn't ask you. I wouldn't expect you to know. Do I know? No. Okay? I'm making an assumption here. I go along the line that seems most meaningful to me, but it doesn't really matter. It could just as easily go the other way. Okay, so now let's here look. He worries already about the final practical. Whoa. Okay. Here you're seeing something. It's a silver stain, which is why it is so very, very dark. Odontoblasts are here. Those are the ones. These are the odontoblasts. Okay. All of these guys here. And then this is pre-dentin. And now the mineralized dentin is the darker mass. And what you're seeing is, here at the calcification front, or the mineralization front, you're seeing this here. That is, I would call that globular, okay? You see globules like this, and then you see actually out in front, you see little globules all over the place like this. So this is definitely a globular mineralization front. Most of the time, when you have large globules, and the mineralization front doesn't move too fast, these globules will kind of gradually fuse together and become all one solid mass of mineralized dentin. But sometimes it doesn't happen. And so in the dentin, in the fully formed dentin, you can have areas like this. This is now ground section. These areas like this show you the globules of mineralization. This is a globule. This is a globule. Okay. And these globules did not come all the way together, and so there are areas, and this is known as an interglobular dentin area, in between those globules, which is essentially like pre-dentin. And you find these. You find these in adult teeth, and they will never disappear. Okay, again, the tubules are going this way. Interglobular dentin areas in some parts of the tooth are fairly normal. The tooth is somewhat stressed when the dentin mineralizes at that point, but if it gets excessive, it is not normal. And as I said, if an individual is hypophosphatemic, you tend to get less well mineralized dentin. All right, the last thing that I wanted to discuss with you is odontoblast crowding. Odontoblast crowding occurs because of the geometry. So you have two things. The geometry of the tooth. That's the first thing. And the second thing is because of the incisocervical gradient in which dentin is being formed. Let me show you what happens. When odontoblasts first start laying down dentin, this is now in the cervical area, the odontoblasts form one single layer. Each cell is right there, and they leave their little cell processes behind, but they have one single layer of cells. Now, when you go in the same tooth, you go a little bit further up, what you find is something like this. Here's one odontoblast, this is the next odontoblast, this is the next odontoblast. Odontoblasts form multiple layers, the cell bodies do, but each one has a cell process going inside the dentin. And so regardless of where the cell body is located, there is a cell process going into the dentin. And so we call this pseudo-stratification. Okay? The concept of pseudo-stratification you probably already heard about when we did respiratory epithelium. You may have heard about pseudo-stratification there. Yes? No? Dr. Cliver, did they learn it?
Yes.
They learned it. Okay, so review it already. Pseudo-stratification is when all of the cells are sitting on the basal lamina, but not all of them reach up all the way. Well, in the case of the odontoblasts, pseudo-stratification, the cell bodies may be stratified, but all cells have a cell process going into the dentin. They started out as a single layer, but gradually they pushed into each other, and there was not enough space left for these cells to all stay next to the predentin. Before we go to this little item, I will just explain to you what I meant. I said it was a geometric and an incisocervical gradient. The geometric thing is that in the incisal area, if an odontoblast starts forming here, and an odontoblast starts laying down dentin here and here and here, it's very easy to realize how they are beginning to be crowded into each other. And so the fact that you have a closed cone where the cells near the tip are literally acutely pushing each other away. Most of the crowding and most of the pseudo-stratification occurs in this area. In the case of a root where you have essentially a situation where you have a cylinder, that crowding is not quite so enormous. So in the case of the root, crowding is not as great as you find in the incisal region. Now, this is a diagram based on computer models and also literally drawn models that Osborne produced as long ago as 1967, but still it holds. And essentially what Osborne did is that, okay, this is the DEJ, and at the end of the morphodifferentiation, the DEJ has its final dimension, that's the shape of the DEJ, and the actual surface area are finalized. And so we consider this a finalized dimension. And now along this dimension, there are, say, 10 odontoblasts starting to form here. 10 odontoblasts start forming here in an incisocervical gradient. And by the time you have T1, the cells that were near the incisal area have done most of the work. They have produced most of the dentin. And when you come to this point that says O1, the cells are just beginning. Okay, we go to the next stage. Next stage is a little bit further down, T2. These cells have continued to produce more dentin, and now the new cells have added this much dentin. Now you get to O2. And so you can continue on, and for each of these timelines, you can say, okay, more dentin cuts formed, and at this point you have as many odontoblasts as indicated here. But something else has to happen. And what happens is that if you are measuring the DEJ, the length of the DEJ, even if it's a linear dimension here, and you start to lay out the first 10 odontoblasts along this line segment, and now you look at this line segment here, what you realize is that these line segments are getting smaller and smaller and smaller, because you take the same number of cells, but they come to lie on a smaller surface. And so what you need to do is for each of these lines at the time points, you now have to distribute the space for a larger number of cells and say, okay, each cell has the same amount of space. But what it means is that there's less and less for each of the cells. And that's the crowding factor. And if you were to make a line that goes through each one of these time points for O1 and for O2 and for O3, what you find is that these lines are becoming S-shaped. So the S-shaped curvature of the dentinal tubules is in fact produced by the fact that the odontoblasts become more crowded during the time when they are producing dentin, going from a larger surface area to a smaller surface area and starting in the incisal edge and then having this incisocervical gradient. I would like you, if possible, to think through this particular thing. If you understand that, you understand, believe me, the whole concept of the dentin formation and also much of the structure of dentin. So, the primary S-shaped curvature of dental tubules and the pseudostratification of the odontoblast are being produced as a result of odontoblast crowding. At this point, let's take a break, and I will then give you a brief introduction to the lab.
Okay.
What's happening here? Oh, okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.